This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. While conservatives today play a dominant role in mainstream politics, there was once a time when they were on the fringe of American political life. One man who set out to change that was William F. Buckley, Jr. His first book, God and Man at Yale, published in 1951, just after his graduation from Yale, was a full frontal attack on an academic culture he deemed too tolerant of atheistic left-wing ideas. It was not Buckley's last word on the subject. 4 years later, he founded National Review magazine, which became fertile ground for the cultivation and growth of conservative ideology. In the 1960s, he took to the airwaves with Firing Line, where he sparred with stars of the left, such as Gore Vidal and Norman Mailer, in witty, acerbic exchanges. Over the years, Buckley has seen the conservative movement grow in stature and power, and is credited with being the intellectual engine that spurred that growth. Buckley recently gave up his controlling shares in National Review, passing the torch on to a new generation of conservatives. His new autobiography, Miles Gone By, has just been published. Mr. Buckley joins us now by phone from his home in Connecticut. If you have some questions for William Buckley, some thoughts about the current state of the conservative movement, give us a call. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And thanks for joining us, Mr. Buckley. Hello, are you there? I don't hear William Buckley on the line.
Oh, my goodness. did they disconnect us?
No, we've got you now. That's one of those heart-stopping moments in radio broadcasting.
Well, I'm glad you were as shocked as I was.
And I'm glad you're there.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. I wanted to begin where your autobiography begins, because in the beginning of your book, you paint a picture of your childhood in Connecticut, and it sounds both privileged and absolutely idyllic. And I wondered how that life, how your childhood and upbringing shaped who you became as an adult, both intellectually and politically.
Well, I think that's easier for others to judge than yourself. In my book, I tell you know, everything what happened, what my major concerns and challenges were. But it's not an essay in psychological self-exploration in which I talk about how my mother's smile influenced me or my schoolmates' challenge in football. It's not that kind of book. But on the other hand, it doesn't conceal anything. It doesn't conceal anything that I wouldn't want to conceal.
No, but it almost, my sense in reading it was, this is a world that doesn't exist anymore and had to have some influence on your own worldview, the way you saw things growing up that way.
Well, I see your point that I was, quote-unquote, privileged, but it's also true that there an awful lot of people in active life who had similar backgrounds, who tended in different ideological directions. I remember one time, I think it was 1958, the three people who were running for governor of New York, one was a left-wing Democrat, one was a left-wing Republican, and the other a left-wing Trotskyite. All of them were children of multimillionaires brought up in circumstances not all that different from mine, except that they were much wealthier.
Well, at one point you were sent to England for boarding school, and it was a Catholic boarding school. We have some tape of you reading an excerpt from the book which describes that experience and how it affected you. Let's first just listen to that excerpt.
Okay.
I had been, notwithstanding my distance from home, very happy at St. John's, and I knew absolutely about this, there simply was no doubt, that I had a deep and permanent involvement in Catholic Christianity. They say about alcoholics that they are never cured. I am a senior citizen and my faith has never left me, and I must suppose that Father Sharkey and Father Payne and Father Manning had something to do with it. They and the closeness I felt every morning to the mystical things that were taking place at the altar.
Catholicism was something that really did set you apart in many ways, both at Yale when you were a student there, and then not set you apart, but certainly gave you a very distinct identity. And I would think, in some level, influenced the kind of conservatism that you believed in.
Well, I suppose the Catholic Church certainly 50 years ago was distinctively cognizant of ages and centuries gone by, and was therefore, I suppose, less alienable than other faiths, and especially non-faiths. I don't remember that there was the phenomenon at Yale of other Catholics being vociferously more conservative than other Protestants or other Jews, but I've never actually done that research. You bring the point up for the first time. It's an interesting question.
Well, it was also part of Catholicism in the 1950s, I think, or I remember, that anti-communism was certainly something, a strong component for many Catholics.
Absolutely correct. That was the age of Cardinal Mencetti, who was ousted and spent the rest of his life in the American embassy. It was the age in which the repression of Christianity was at its most acute. Stalin decided during those years that he had to do everything he could to extirpate Christianity, so that there was a response to that kind of pressure from the Christian community, and I suppose certainly from the Catholic community, though, of course, we weren't talking about Roman Catholics, but rather Orthodox. But I see your point. I think it's correct.
And also, I was thinking as I was contemplating talking with you that many people who grew up in that era or in the 60s certainly have a historic sense of what it was like then, but some younger listeners may not. I was wondering if you could sort of describe what was the atmosphere in the country like when National Review was founded in 1955, particularly for a conservative such as yourself.
Well, it was during the high days of President Eisenhower. He had defeated Senator Taft in 1952, and Senator Taft died a few months after Eisenhower was inaugurated. And there was a kind of placidity attaching to Eisenhower, which not only, in our judgment, affected the mood, the sort of silent 50s mood, but also affected policy. The anti-communist crystallization hadn't really happened. It was kind of lazy and untargeted. So we had, for instance, the Hungarian uprising without any effective protest. So in the late 50s, when National Review was born, there were a lot of people who wanted something to read that was well-informed and staunchly and unapologetically anti-communist and anti-socialist. And National Review did that.
Did you have any idea the influence that magazine would ultimately have, and the way conservatism would change and grow?
The answer is I didn't prophesy it in the sense that you're talking about, but I knew that it would have an appeal to people who were looking for more crystalline waters, and it did. Barry Goldwater was attracted to it very early, and Ronald Reagan was a subscriber even when he was still nominally a Democrat. So that we felt very early on in the life of National Review that we were wired in to people who were politically active on the larger scale. And indeed we were. And of course it was wonderfully gratifying when President Reagan, as president, appeared at the National Review celebration and said that National Review was primarily responsible for his political development. That was very gratifying. I wish he had been there.
We have another excerpt of you reading from your book, and this one deals with what you call my own secret right-wing conspiracy, which sort of gives a sense of the growth of conservatism between Goldwater's defeat in the presidential election and Ronald Reagan's victory. Let's just listen to that, and then we can talk about the story behind that.
That was the conclusive judgment of the establishment. The right-wing critique of American liberalism had now had a final exposure on the national political auction block. History would record simply that Barry Goldwater was a candidate returned by Lyndon Johnson to the parched earth of Phoenix, where dwelled only millionaires seeking dry air to breathe, and the Indians Barry Goldwater would now resume photographing. And then, of course, 16 years later, history was made to stand on its head when Ronald Reagan was swept into office on a platform indistinguishable from what Barry had been preaching. What happened? On their little cat feet, the conservatives, with myriad committees, seminars, assemblies, documentaries, scholarships, leaflets, prayer and fasting, had crept back onto the scene and found themselves in the Oval Office. What happened? My own explanation is John T. Gatti happened.
You have to explain who is John T. Gatti and
well, that's a charming little fantasy.
It's a nice story.
Mr. Gatti was a businessman in Kansas City who, when he died, left about $1.5 million to be distributed every year at a meeting at which the trustees decided on the distribution, and he named the trustees. And they were, you know, the 10 most prominent conservatives in America, including Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan and J. Edgar Hoover, although he did not, in fact, serve, one of the Eisenhower brothers. So every year we would meet and give, it came to about $10,000 each of us to this or that scholar or foundation or thriving conservative. And in the course of 10 years, we ate up that $1.5 million dollars. And my fantasy—I wrote this piece for the New Yorker—was that those with all the critical junctions, which when they finally matured, caused the conservative revolution. Kind of fun to read.
And you said it takes a long time for a revolution to build and to grow, and you certainly watched this one build and grow. When did you have a sense that things were changing politically in America?
When Goldwater was nominated.
When Goldwater was nominated at that point.
That would have been simply excluded even 10 years earlier. So when he triumphed in man-to-man contests with such as Nelson Rockefeller, who was then thought of as the voice of liberal republicanism, that marked a tremendous historical turn. Now, he was, of course, the devastatingly defeated. What happened was that there were two banks of critics of that event. One bank said, you see, that's what happens when these reactionaries get too noisy. We just simply put them down. Another branch, which included National News, said, okay, that kind of thing happens. But the idea is that Senator Goldwater was preaching our ideas that, in our judgment, have taken significant political route, and of course they did, and as has been sometimes said about it, his victory was postponed by 16 years and was consummated by Ronald Reagan.
We're going to continue our discussion with William F. Buckley after a short break. We're going to be taking your calls at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking with William F. Buckley Jr. today about his life and legacy recounted in his new autobiography, Miles Gone By. You're invited to join the discussion. If you have questions for Mr. Buckley, give us a call at 800-989-TALK. And Mr. Buckley, I think we're going to take a call now. We have a number of people holding on for you.
Okay.
So let's start with Ellen in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Hi, Mr. Buckley. I have a question for you. Basically, in terms of the fundamental tenets of the conservative movement, which I take to be, I don't know, among others, the size of government, fiscal responsibility and accountability, constitutional issues like the right to privacy and the separation of church and state, and limited international involvement, I'm just wondering, in your broad understanding of American conservatism, how the current administration fits into those principles.
Well, all administrations have to contend with the challenges of the day. Now, I have distinguished, and so has my magazine, between those politicians who attempt to go further in the right direction than mere circumstances would seem to permit, and those others who simply submit to those circumstances. I think that in an examination of President Bush, one can find a little of each. He's very submissive on the matter of deficit spending and in the growth of entitlement programs, but very firm on some aspects of foreign policy. So that's an answer to your question, an attempted answer to your question.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Alan. And let's go to Scott. He is in Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Yeah, I was just calling to ask Mr. Buckley about the evolution of anti-elitist rhetoric within the conservative movement. It begins with relatively thoughtful analyses of the new class, and then basically just has sort of morphed into anyone who disagrees with the conservatives or an elitist, no matter, you know, whether they have a high school diploma and are a Hollywood actor, you know, versus oil company executives who are from the Ivy League and have MBAs.
I have found that a clumsy word to use because, of course, the rigorously used, the word elite refers to those who are in some sense more privileged than non-elite, either educationally or in terms of wealth or in terms of opportunity. But all three of those seem to me to be confused in the malusage of the word as you and I, as you have cited, so that I think we have to look for something a little bit more discriminating before we can generalize on how to make those divisions.
I just think that for a real conservative, you know, an elite and a democracy wouldn't be a bad thing.
Well, it depends what kind of elite you're talking about. The people who wrote our Constitution were certainly elite. They were the most educated, the most experienced, in some senses, most patriotic. On the other hand, they submitted to the popular vote, though the franchise wasn't all that extensive in those days. So I think we're both saying the thing. We should encourage elites, and we've been doing that. The 40% of the American people graduate from college these days as compared to 4% 50 years ago. So there's a passage in the direction of maximizing the elite.
Thanks for your call, Scott.
Thank you.
What is your assessment of the state of conservatism now in this country, the conservative movement in this country now? One does sometimes hear that within the Republican Party, there are divisions that fall roughly down the line of the social conservatives versus the economic conservatives. Is there a divide happening? How is that going to affect the Republican Party?
Well, I think it's true that some people primarily identify conservatism with minimizing tax, minimizing government, and other people have a scale of interest that includes civil liberties, civil liberties even for the unborn, and to insist that the one group and the other are constitutionally hostile is, I think, incorrect. Most of the social conservatives I have bumped into are also conservatives in the other sense that you're talking about.
Well, here's an email that speaks to this somewhat from April in California. Please speak to how the religious right became aligned with the conservative movement. I believe this is a major factor in keeping self-described liberals from thoughtfully considering the conservative point of view. It certainly turns me off.
I think that's probably true, because the conservative Christians continue to adhere to certain ideas and certain policies which were absolutely conventional in America for the first 250 years of its existence, like permitting prayer at school, just to give an example. That's considered now extremely provocative, and those people who find it provocative are capable of turning against the entire movement. I think that's irrational, but that simply becomes an educational problem for all parties.
It's interesting, in looking at this, we started earlier talking about your own early writings, your early roots, your conservatism, which was linked with your religion, Catholicism, the conservative...
But it wasn't linked to it.
No? No,
I mean, I'm a Catholic and I'm a conservative, but nobody has devised a means of saying that my Catholicism bred more people who have my particular politics. The great majority of Catholics in America voted Democratic during the period you're talking about.
Right. But do you have any concerns then about the intersection of religion and politics, particularly on the Christian right, as it's?
I'm concerned that they don't intersect enough. It seems to me that what keeps America distinctive is its allegiance to broad principles. These are enunciated in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution. And an adherence to principles is in most senses, religious in its notion. The idea that we are all born equal is a distinctively religious idea. It doesn't exist other than in religion. To the extent that we simply ignore it, we tend, I think, to loosen our moorings. And it's for that reason that many people are concerned in the matter.
Another email from Paul in San Diego. Have you changed your mind on anything concerning civil rights, defense, the environment, taxes, etc., since the inception of National Review?
You're not going to ask me to answer that question.
Do you want to take one of those topics?
Well, whichever one you want.
How about civil rights?
Okay. We were, at National Review, we opposed the 1964 Act for the same reason that Barry Goldwater did. We thought it unconstitutional. We may have been right on that narrow point, and some liberal constitutional scholars have said we were right on that point, but I think politically we were wrong, by which I mean I think that the Civil Rights Act gave an impulse to the civil rights movement, which might indeed have happened in the same sense that we might have freed the slaves if we hadn't had a civil war. But retrospectively, I think that jump start was worth whatever constitutional shortcuts were being taken.
Mr. Buckley, you helped pave the way for the next generation of conservatives, and among the newcomers is Tucker Carlson, the bow-tied co-host of CNN's Crossfire, more recently host of the PBS show Unfiltered, and he is with me now in Studio 3A. Tucker Carlson, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening.
Tucker, how are you doing?
Hey, Mr. Buckley, I'm doing great. How are you?
I know you're doing great. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Do you feel like you are taking on the mantle of William Buckley now that you're moving on to this PBS show Unfiltered and with some of the other work you're doing?
Well, I would never presume to claim that or even think it, though I'm heartened by the fact that Mr. Buckley spent so many years on PBS.
Do you remember hearing about William Buckley as you were growing up, and what did you know about him? When did his thinking start filtering into your brain and perhaps having an influence on you?
I read his magazine. I grew up in La Jolla, California, which is a great and lovely place, but cut off from the intellectual currents of places like New York and New England. And so, yeah, magazines like National Review and National Review specifically were a way for me growing up to find out what people were thinking about on the East Coast. Yeah, it was important.
What does Bill Buckley represent then to your generation of conservatives?
principle, a sort of good-humored demeanor. I mean, the thing I've always admired about Bill Buckley is not only did he say things I agreed with, he also seemed like the kind of guy I'd like to have dinner with, which is not something you can say for a lot of people in and around politics.
Invited any time, Duggan.
Well, thank you. I forgot you're still on. I'm embarrassed. No, but it's true. I mean, that's, you know, having spent the last 10 or 12 years around a lot of politicians, even ones I like, at the back of my mind, I often think, you know, I'm glad I don't spend a lot of my personal time with this person because they tend to be consumed with politics, and even the ones who mean what they say tend to be a little humorless, and no one has ever said that about Bill Buckley.
No. I was going to say, Bill Buckley, that your show Firing Line, I think, may have been the first program that sort of combined politics and entertainment so effectively. But I wonder, when you look at some of the programs that are out there now that may be following in those footsteps, if you feel there's sort of a coarsening of the political discourse that's taking place.
Well, a Firing Line took advantage of a singular patience at that point in the American culture. He was a program that went for 58 and a half minutes, and that was an awfully long time. I remember when I did a program in London with Harold Macmillan, and after 35 minutes on the air, he turned around and said, "I say, isn't this over yet?" it reflected that creep that we have felt in the direction of insisting that you had to have a break every second. You may have noticed in modern movies, I'm not exaggerating, it's very seldom more than 1.5 seconds that the camera rests on any particular situation. And now, you know, whereas we used to have 1 hour of news every night, we now have a half hour, and it's substantially interrupted. That does have to do, I think, with the abbreviation of American patience to listen. In Firing Line, you know, people were permitted to say what they wanted, and they could take time to do it. That would make a lot of people nervous. And indeed, 5 years before we ended Firing Line, I cut the program from 1 hour to 30 mm-hmm. minutes because so many station managers were horrified at the notion of devoting an entire hour to a static situation. You at NPR, of course, have the terrific advantage of transcending that, or at least trying to.
We work on it.
Sure do.
I'm talking with William F. Buckley, Jr., and also joining me today in the studio is Tucker Carlson. We are discussing Mr. Buckley's new autobiography. We're also talking about politics and the state of the American conservative movement right now. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a number at 1-800-989-8255. And you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tucker Carlson, what about that question I just asked Mr. Buckley, and that is the sort of the coarsening of political discourse now and the anger that's out there, I guess you might say.
Well, let me first say I agree that people's attention spans are short. Since I work in television, I could bore you for hours with just how short they are. I think it has something to do with the fact that people don't read very much, and particularly read books. I mean, there's something about the act of reading a book that requires sustained concentration. You have to think through an idea or a series of ideas over the course of a number of days.
I think that's quite true.
It trains you to think in longer terms, longer meaning longer than, say, 30 seconds. So, yeah, I think that's definitely a problem. As to the anger, the bitterness, the hostility, and just the partisanship and the dumbness that inevitably results from partisanship, yeah, it's there. It's counterproductive. It has a huge effect on what I do for a living, working on Crossfire at CNN. I see it every single day. I'm going to see it in a couple hours from now. I don't think it's a good thing. And I actually don't think, just as a pure political matter, it's all that effective. I don't think personal attacks work very well, even when they're justified, even when they're true, even when you can back them up with the facts.
Even when those bastards are involved, huh?
That's exactly right. I mean, Clinton's impeachment, to me, just again from a purely political standpoint, is the lesson of the decade, if not century, politically. And it's this. Impeachment showed that almost everything Clinton's enemies said about him was true, all of it. I mean, you could get it there, you know, on the internet, under oath, you know, in the Star Report. And yet what happened? His approval rating went up at the end. of the impeachment process. That tells you everything you need to know about the political effect of personal attacks, and yet some people obviously haven't learned that lesson.
Quickly, I'd like to see if we can get in one more call before we have to go. Richard in Oregon. Hi, Richard, go ahead.
Hi there. I'd like to ask Mr. Buckley, when you were doing your TV program, Firing Line, and you would be doing your verbal joust with Norman Mailer and anybody else that would come on your show, even though you disagreed with each other on just about every issue, you didn't get personal with each other. It was a friendly rivalry. I'm right. No, I'm right. And today it seems like with the left versus the right, or the right versus the left, is that there is no tolerance on either side of the other side's argument. And I'd like to know why you think that's occurring.
All right. Thanks for that question, Richard. Mr.
Well,
Buckley?
I think Tucker Carlson would answer that with greater experience than I. He continues on and sees these situations hand to hand. I'm having lunch tomorrow with Professor Don Kenneth Galbraith, who's one of my oldest and dearest friends, but it hasn't diluted the purity of his faith or of mine. And I guess that kind of thing doesn't go on so much. But as I say, Tucker Carlson could enlighten us on the subject. Does he have a difficult time socializing with liberals?
I don't. I'm surrounded by them in every part of my life. I think we're... I'm the only person who feels the way I do in my neighborhood, I'd bet. I don't know the answer. Here's my theory. You know, the old line about how academic battles are the most bitter because the stakes are so low. I think that it's in some sense related to that. If you stand back a couple of feet and look at the relative positions of the candidates in this election on the issues that matter, starting with Iraq, they're not so far from one another. I mean, both Kerry and Bush believe we ought to stay the course there, whatever that means. Both think we might need new troops. Both think we should expand the military. Neither one is calling for nationalizing the railroads or, you know, throwing anyone in an internment camp. They're both pretty centrist candidates. I know that'll infuriate listeners to hear, but I think history will record them that way, that the invasion of Iraq was not a centrist thing to do, of course. But with that exception, I think they're both pretty much in the center. I think I've just noticed, again, I'm not sure why this is, but as a phenomenon, I know it's real, that people who have starkly different worldviews tend to get along better. I mean, you know, Al Sharpton and I can almost always have dinner and have a marvelous time. Much harder for me to eat with your average liberal.
Okay. Unfortunately, we have we are running out of time, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today, Mr. Buckley.
Nice to talk to you, and for the nice surprise to have Tucker Carlson there.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us also, Tucker Carlson. It's Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington.